Jacobs is one of the women leading the event and has been working with the girls during Nadoya Dion.
The work that we're doing with them right now is healing multiple generations.
Her family started to gather every few months. About a year ago, they transitioned the family gatherings into a community event for teenage girls.
To just empower them with knowledge about their bodies and just surround them with a lot of love and support throughout these big transitions in life that can sometimes feel kind of scary or isolating.
Kimalik Teeter is Yupikan Chupik from St. Mary's. She says she came to the workshop because she wanted to learn how to guide her 4-year-old daughter. She realized that she herself still wants guidance.
You get of age of different things all throughout your life.
Teeter says that in Yupik culture, the ceremonies celebrate different milestones, like when a woman catches her first fish, makes her first thing, and has her first baby. Teeter says that the workshop reminded her that it's not too late to honor transitions in her life.
Maybe, deep down, I just really wanted this for me, not just for my baby. So, yeah.
The workshop closed with two activities. Women and girls wrote affirmation for themselves and others and connected them by a string. They also made heating pads filled with rice and fragrances. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naiden.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Thanks so much for listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 4th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Althea Billings and Josh Salem. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Our director of evening news is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. COP30 Global Conference on Climate Change ended well short of expectations. Xi Jinping calls Trump. What's that about? And the phony war in Venezuela is still an option. First, the COP30 conference ended well short of expectations. Donald Trump tried very hard to make COP30 fail, but as Catherine Osborne reports for the Foreign Policy magazine, Brazil's president and host for the conference, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, had other ideas. A key pillar of Brazil's approach to COP30, she writes, is what some climate strategists call coalitions of the doing. The idea is to work with small groups of countries that want to move forward on climate action. So, for example, in the lead-up to COP30, the Brazilians helped craft a plan for a new investment fund to protect tropical forests that had received some $5.5 billion in pledges as of last week. Brazil and the United Kingdom announced a program to help seven countries track and reduce so-called super pollutants, such as methane. and Brazil rallied at least 9 countries and the European Union to join a group devoted to collaborating on carbon markets. Interest is also widespread, especially in Southeast Asia, on adoption of green energy technologies, China's strong point. Here again, the United States is odd man out. Despite these efforts, the conference ran into overtime because of disagreements about reliance on fossil fuels and financing of developing countries' climate change plans. The Europeans demanded a clear statement on moving away from fossil fuels, even as European energy companies are right now investing more in fossil fuels to meet rising demand. The Arab states don't want to restrict oil exports, and developing countries such as Nigeria argue that their economic growth depends on fossil fuels. The contradictions extend to Brazil itself, where the state oil companies have a contract to explore for oil near the mouth of the Amazon. In the end, the final COP30 statement avoided any mention of a transition away from fossil fuels. One commentator concluded, quote, "Instead of being remembered as historic, the conference will likely further erode confidence in a process that many environmentalists and even some world leaders have argued isn't up to the challenge of confronting global temperature rise." Even United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said, quote, "I cannot pretend that COP30 has delivered everything that is needed. The gap between where we are and what science demands remains dangerously wide." Xi Jinping calls Trump. What was that about? It is highly unusual for President Xi Jinping to initiate a call to the U.S. president, but he did so on November 24th, following their meeting in Korea. Xi was remarkably effusive about China-U.S. relations. According to the official Chinese readout, Xi said, "Since the meeting in Busan, the China-U.S. relationship has generally maintained a steady and positive trajectory, and this is welcomed by the two countries and the broader international community. What has happened demonstrates yet again that the description of China-U.S. cooperation benefiting both sides and confrontation hurting both sides reflects a common sense that has been repeatedly proven by experience, and the vision of China and the U.S. helping each other succeed and prospering together is a tangible prospect within reach." He said that Trump called him a great leader. Trump hailed the phone call on Truth Social, citing agreements on fentanyl and agricultural exports. Quote, "We have done a good and very important deal for our great farmers, and it will only get better. Our relationship with China is extremely strong. Since our meeting in South Korea, there has been significant progress on both sides in keeping our agreements current and accurate. Now we can set our sights on the big picture," unquote. What is the big picture? Trump didn't say, but surely it's a comprehensive trade deal. Yet Chinese purchases of soybeans are far below what they committed to buy this year. Xi did not mention any soybeans, fentanyl, or other subject brought up by Trump. Xi only talked about Ukraine and Taiwan. He stressed the importance of concluding a fair and binding agreement on Ukraine. He may have been calling to see in what way China might play a part, but his main concern was Taiwan. He reiterated China's long-standing position on foreign interference in an internal Chinese matter. He acknowledged Trump's support for the One China principle. My guess is that Xi brought up Taiwan because of new tensions in China's relations with Japan. The new Japanese Prime Minister, Takaichi Sanai, said Japan would have to help defend Taiwan from a Chinese attack as a matter of national survival. That statement goes beyond anything a Japanese leader had said before. Coming from a leader who is hawkish on China and committed to a significant increase in Japan's military capabilities, the statement produced angry Chinese reactions. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman, for example, said Takaichi's position, quote, "has fundamentally eroded the political foundation of China-Japan relations." Trump obtained a long-sought invitation to visit China in April, which Xi will reciprocate later in the year. That little gift from Xi probably helped secure something important to Xi, that Trump would rein in Takaichi, putting improvement in relations with China ahead of U.S.-Japan relations, and for that matter, ahead of Taiwan security. And Trump delivered, advising Takaichi to lower the volume on Taiwan. Takaichi apparently listened. In response to opposition politicians' questions in Parliament, she danced around policy on Taiwan and did not repeat her controversial statement. All this hullabaloo has Taiwan on edge. Trump did not say anything in response to Xi's defense of Chinese policy on Taiwan. The conversation thus feeds into apprehension in Taipei's leadership, which, in contrast with the view of the minority nationalist party, the Kuomintang, which favors greater contact with China, believes that Taiwan's security depends on solid ties with the United States. That is why the Lai Ching-te administration in Taiwan is increasing military spending at an unprecedented level, and why Taiwan semiconductor manufacturing has promised major new investments in the United States, all in an effort to satisfy Donald Trump. Next, the phony war in Venezuela is still an option. President Trump has wavered in public remarks about what he's going to do about Venezuela. He said he has talked with Nicolas Maduro, but according to CNN, it was an ultimatum that Maduro resign if he and his family want safe passage out of the country. At his cabinet meeting Tuesday, Trump again threatened the use of force against drug cartels, not just in Venezuela, but in other countries. And Trump has told U.S. airlines to stay out of Venezuelan airspace. It's a calculated strategy of intimidation, with direct U.S. intervention probably the last option. The rationale for going after Maduro is paper thin, that he is the head of Cartel de los Soles, or Cartel of the Suns, a group that doesn't exist. As Phil Gunson, a senior analyst at the International Crisis Group based in Caracas, says, Cartel de los Soles is a pejorative Venezuelan term for corrupt figures in the armed forces who take money from drug traffickers. The name is a reference to the sun insignia on their uniforms. An order by the Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth, adds to the illegality of U.S. attacks in the Caribbean. During the first attack, September 2nd, on a boat allegedly carrying drugs, two men survived, clinging to the side of the boat. Hegseth reportedly personally ordered them killed in a second assault, though he has denied giving the order and refuses to turn over tapes to the House committee that is investigating his actions. He and Trump are pointing to an admiral in a clear case of scapegoating. Legal experts say this act against unarmed, unthreatening people could be a war crime. Hegseth defended his role, saying, quote, our current operations in the Caribbean are lawful under both U.S. and international law, with all actions in compliance with the law of armed conflict, and approved by the best military and civilian lawyers up and down the chain of command, unquote. Trump told reporters Hegseth didn't say that, the kill order. But a CNN reporter asked aloud if that order may have been responsible for the subsequent departure of two top military officials. An article in Foreign Affairs offers several reasons why any kind of U.S. military action against Venezuela is likely to fail to unseat Maduro. Instead, the author suggests that the U.S. bring Maduro and his opponents to the bargaining table for a power-sharing arrangement. The question that argument doesn't answer is this: what right does the U.S. have to intervene in another country's internal political affairs and try to force a governing arrangement? In other news, Europe's proposal for a Ukraine peace. After being blindsided by a Russia-U.S. peace proposal, European leaders met in Switzerland and came up with an alternative plan that is far friendlier to Ukraine than a plan that originated in Moscow. As reported by The Guardian, the plan says, quote, negotiations over territory should take place after a ceasefire is agreed and should start from the line of contact, the existing front line. It says both parties would agree how any truce would be monitored under U.S. supervision. Unlike the White House text, the European alternative does not call for Kyiv to withdraw from cities it controls in eastern Donbass, nor does it rule out Ukraine's membership in NATO, but Bud does point out that there is no consensus over its membership within NATO. There are further eye-catching proposals. They include that Russia give the occupied Zaporizhia nuclear power station to the International Atomic Energy Agency, which would split power 50-50 between Moscow and Kyiv. Ukraine's army would be capped during peacetime at 800,000 soldiers, 200,000 more than in the U.S. draft. Frozen Russian assets would also be used to reconstruct Ukraine, rather than being partly given to U.S. investors. If Moscow were to respect a sustainable peace, according to the European plan, sanctions imposed since 2014 would be gradually eased and Russia would be brought back into the Group of Eight. Now the ball is in Russia's court as Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner meet with Putin. U.S. immigration policy is virtually let no one in. The Trump administration is embracing an immigration policy that goes completely against the American experience. Now, virtually no one is welcome. The latest victims are people from Myanmar, Somalia, and Afghanistan. The administration is ending temporary protected status for Myanmar refugees, despite the ongoing civil war that is the basis for protected status. Somalis have also long had protected status, but that too is ending, again despite the upheaval in their home country. Trump said Somalis have caused great trouble in Minnesota, without evidence, of course. ICE launched an operation Tuesday against Somalis in Minneapolis. Their country stinks, said Trump, and we don't want them in our country. Right after an Afghan asylum seeker shot two National Guard members in Washington, Trump declared that he will permanently pause migration from all third world countries, pause asylum applications, and stop issuing visas to Afghan refugees. Even people who are in the United States will not have their asylum petitions considered. Nor will Afghanis who helped the United States during their war and been placed under a special immigrant visa program be granted visas for now, in apparent violation of federal law. It's apparent that the shooting was all that Trump and Stephen Miller needed as justification for realizing their whites-only immigration plan. The admission of 7,500 Afrikaners from South Africa and the appointment of a U.S. ambassador to South Africa who criticizes the anti-apartheid struggle of Nelson Mandela are further proof of how explicitly racist U.S. immigration policy has become. In case you missed it, by the way, here is Trump's Thanksgiving Day message on immigration. Quote, "A very happy Thanksgiving salutation to all of our great American citizens and patriots who have been so nice in allowing our country to be divided, disrupted, carved up, murdered, beaten, mugged, and laughed at, along with certain other foolish countries throughout the world, for being politically correct and just plain stupid when it comes to immigration." Unquote. Finally, two updates. From Brazil, where former President Jair Bolsonaro has been sentenced to 27 years in prison, starting immediately. The Supreme Court found that Bolsonaro was a flight risk after he tried to remove his ankle monitoring bracelet and sought refuge in several embassies. Trump said he would be speaking with Bolsonaro soon, only to find that Bolsonaro was already in prison. Perhaps Trump thought the U.S. Embassy in Brazil would protect Bolsonaro, but Brazil never gave him a chance. And then from Israel, the Israeli Defense Forces remain active outside Israel's borders, especially in Lebanon, where it assassinated Hezbollah's chief military leader in Beirut. Sources in Lebanon say that Israel's attacks are weakening the Lebanese government and preventing it from disarming Hezbollah, an aim that has public support. Other observers see these military moves as stemming from Prime Minister Netanyahu's ambition to keep international tensions high during the upcoming election campaign. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Lizard. At Portland City Council's meeting on Wednesday, councilors discussed an amendment to a resolution on the city's investment policies presented by Councilor Samir Kanal. Normally, this is an unexciting reapproval. State law requires that Oregon cities readopt their investment policy each year. This year, Kanal wrote an amendment to the policy to stop investing in corporations and businesses that support human rights atrocities. Portland policy already prevents investment in oil, alcohol, casinos, correctional facilities, small arms, and security services. However, it allows investments to aerospace, heavy arms, and gasoline industries.
So the amendment that I'm proposing is to the resolution, not to the policy itself. And it outlines a way forward for a pathway to an ethical investment policy over the coming months that can be implemented during 2026. It doesn't change this year's investment policy, doesn't name any specific countries, and it will not change this year's investments. What it's designed to do is add a whereas clause. It's context setting, noting what I already said, that we have some values-based parameters on investments, not just what gets the biggest yield. And it adds three resolves that urge the mayor to work with interested council offices to develop options on how to implement an ethical investment policy, define the minimum goals for that, a human rights-based screen on a goal that the city doesn't invest directly or indirectly in war, human rights violations, or violations of international law, things like genocide, slavery, torture. Urge the administration to come back to a full public council meeting and discuss those options and use feedback from that so that we can all collectively shape the next city investment policy. And then they also encourages the mayor to do community outreach on this topic, including with relevant boards and commissions, and include interested council offices in that process so that we can co-create across branches and build something where there is the time to get it done and get it done well in the future.
Most of the written testimony calls on the city to divest from major corporations and to create a human rights screen on the city's investments. These kinds of limitations have come up before. Spoken testimony mirrors the values of the amendment and the written testimony.
Hi, my name is Jerry McCorkle. Good afternoon. I'm a Portland resident, homeowner, taxpayer, and voter, and I'm here today to urge you to vote yes to update the Portland investment policy to better align with the values that Portland strives to embody. No one waxes poetic about the glories of bygone Portland of yesteryear. My great-grandparents lived through the exclusion, relocation, and incarceration of Portlanders just because they were Black, Indigenous, or immigrants. My grandparents saw the Ku Klux Klan running the Portland Police Bureau. My parents saw the redlining and the destruction of the albino neighborhood. More recently, you and I all saw a lumber baron try to run this city into the ground to benefit his landed gentry cronies. We can do better. Your vote in favor of this policy can be a huge step forward from that dark history. Or your vote against it will be remembered when Portlanders vote against you. Because we all know that Portland can do better, that you can do better, that this is what you were elected for. When I pay my property taxes, I want that money to help people, to improve the common welfare. I do wish this initiative went further. I'm a military veteran, and much like the person who becomes a vegan after working in a slaughterhouse, I do not want my Portland taxes to support the military-industrial complex's murder of foreign and domestic civilians.
My name is Emily Hawley, and I'm a lawyer with experience in atrocity crimes investigations. I'm currently counsel at the Sanctions Law Center, but here in my personal capacity. One key flaw within our international legal system, which largely focuses on state conduct, is that corporations, which rival states in power, influence, and potential human rights consequences, remain largely unregulated. Corporations are further structured to insulate from risk and evade liability. They can distance themselves from unsavory practices like Nestle subsidiaries, child slavery. So relying on legal systems alone to ensure corporate accountability is wholly inadequate. Within this somewhat anarchic system, we, the investors, the consumers, and the labor are the forces that shape these industries. We check their malfeasance and we protect one another. And the return on our investments is not just monetary. The world we invest in is the world we create. Whether we fund surveillance technology abroad that is already coming home or green energy systems. With immigrant communities under attack, and US tax dollars funding genocides, we can no longer afford to look away from the true cost of our investment policies. I am particularly glad this proposal recognizes that human rights screening alone is inadequate, and we must account for other grave violations of international law, including the laws of war and atrocity crimes. I ask that Portland join cities across the United States in incorporating this ethical investment screening and appreciate the counselors who have led on this so far.
Back in 2014, then first-term city commissioner Steve Novick led an effort to get the city to divest from Walmart based on its ethical conduct, abuse of market power, and impact on the environment. Novick had this to say on the amendment.
I'm going to be voting no on the amendment, primarily because I don't think that the administration has any particular expertise in developing an ethical investment policy. I don't think that, I think that we as council members have at least as much expertise in such a thing as anybody in the executive. And it's incumbent on us to work to develop a more comprehensive socially responsible investment policy. So I just want to say that. Also, I just want to mention that I obviously have no objection to the idea that we should take, you know, human rights violations, including genocide, slavery, torture, et cetera, into account. But I also think that it's important to consider labor violations, ripping off consumers, environmental violations. And we'll note that many companies have more direct control over what they do to their own workers, what they do to the environment, what they do to consumers, than they do over entities they sell stuff to when they sell stuff to everybody. So I think that we need to, if we're going to have a screen, we should expand the screen to include labor, environmental, and consumer violations. I would also note that after I came up with the very limited policy of don't invest in Walmart bonds, we then had a vigorous conversation in the council and with the public over the next year about expanding the policy. And we wound up in a situation where my colleagues decided that they didn't want to be in the business of figuring out which companies were worse, so they just banned all investment in corporate bonds, which both cost the city money and like made no ethical point whatsoever. So that annoyed me, but it did reflect the difficulty of this and why it's hard to come up with something there's to be consensus on. So for example, in addition to the question of what kind of conduct do you think should be taken into account, another issue would be if you're going to go after, I am horrified what Israel has done in Gaza, and what I'm going to say does not diminish this, but if you're going to be making decisions based on relations with particular countries, then you need to think about more than one country. I mean, I personally would want to think about Saudi Arabia, which is one of the 12 countries where homosexuality is punishable by death, a country that led an intervention in the Yemeni civil war that resulted in the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, and where the leader of the country directly ordered the execution and dismemberment of a journalist. So once we start talking about what values we care about, it's a broad conversation. Once we start talking about what countries we're worried about, that's a broad conversation. So although I appreciate people's desire for us to move forward and do something quickly, it gets gnarly. And I, having started this conversation in 2014, I'm eager to engage in it over the next coming months with Councillor Kunal and others who are interested. But again, I think that has to be our discussion. I don't think that the administration has any particular expertise in it. One thing actually that I do agree with is the last be it further resolved in Councillor Kunal's proposal, be it resolved that the council encourage the administration to conduct community outreach in advance of the 2026 City of Portland investment policy, including through relevant boards and commissions, and to include interested council offices in this process. I think that it's going to be up to us to work on what the policy will be, but I do think the administration has the capacity to help us in public involvement.
Nova, for the comments, I do want to say I believe you when you say you care about these issues and are willing to work on this in the future, even if you vote no on the amendment. Also, I'm going to try to respond to the comments and see if I can win you over anyway. First, I agree with three of my colleagues. Councillor Green said it, I think, first, that I personally cannot vote for the administration's proposed investment policy as is. My personal background in human rights has informed my development of an approach to every issue. I can't separate it from human rights. I don't have that capacity to do that. I think about human rights in every decision I make. To the point about labor rights and other things being included in the list, in the second resolved that I'm proposing adding, it lists items in this way: screening potential investments based on human rights, including a list. And that including means that other types of human rights issues beyond those listed are involved in the process I'm asking for, even if they're not listed. I believe that labor rights are human rights. And you know, women's rights are human rights. There's a lot of different categories. LGBT rights are human rights. We could list things, and frankly, maybe I'd write it differently if I was doing it over again. But I want to be clear that these factors are included even if they're not listed because of the word choice of including there. To the point about individual countries, I agree with you. My amendment does not list any specific countries. My background and a commitment to this is deep. Just a quick story. I worked as a student senator when I was in college to amend both our student government's policy on divestment and the statewide student lobby's policy on divestment. This is in 2007. It was originally just focused on Sudan, not by just saying Sudan and another country, but by creating a screen on this. I don't remember which one passed and which failed, but one was successful. It's been a long time. I do think that establishing the goals and purposes and factors is the better path than naming specific countries or companies for that matter. I do think your slippery slope argument's worth examining here. Your history about proposing just an investment in Walmart being avoided avoided, and then that becoming, we don't invest in any corporation. And I want to be clear here, I have no desire to get out of city investments in the private sector as a whole. I want the city to invest in the private sector, and it's not just about yields. The point of divestment campaigns is not to avoid investment or yields. It is to use the leverage of your investment choices to influence behavior of the people you might or might not be investing in. You cannot do that if you don't invest in the private sector at all. So continued investment in the private sector is necessary for this to have any impact whatsoever. Otherwise, it's just, as you said, it has no ethical impact whatsoever. And finally, to the point on who should lead on this, I actually agree with you. That the administration shouldn't be the ones leading on the ethical choice here. And I don't want to toot my own horn here, but I have gone to grad school for human rights. I do intend for my office to be one of the interested council offices. And I think the part about the administration's involvement is about two things. What tools should we use and how would those work? And what are the financial impacts in terms of returns on our investment portfolio as a whole of each potential policy and tool? I actually updated the text of the first resolved based on my knowledge of your thoughts on that prior to it's all reflected in here, so that the administration isn't going away and coming back with options, but that interested council offices are going to be part of that conversation too. And so to be clear, the legislative intent is that we direct the ethics, the what and the why, and they're informing us on the how as well as the how much. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor. Councillor Novick, you're in the queue.
I think that actually it might be possible for me to bring you to language that we could agree on. My concern with the way this is written is it says, be it further resolved that the council urges the administration to develop, in collaboration with interested council offices, options for an ethical investment policy. And I don't think that's the way it should work. Again, I don't think they have any particular expertise in developing options for an ethical investment policy. If, however, it said, we urge the administration to provide feedback to the council and work with the council as the council, as council offices develop options for an ethical investment policy, I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I'm gonna type that up and we can figure that out as the conversation continues, but I have no issue with that.
After further elaboration and adjustment to the language of the amendment, a vote passed unanimously, as did the resolution on the city's investment policy. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Lizard.
I'm Mr. KBOO Portland, full strength community.